Let's bring our minds into a focus. Notice how words are helpful to focus the mind. If the words are structured, the mind will focus. A simple structure is A, B, C, D, E, F, G, etc. You notice how any structured order of language focuses the mind. It's a universal characteristic. Now the alphabet is a little bit long. How if we select just the vowels? A, E, I, O, U. Now how if we add an inflection to the selected vowels? A, E, I, O, U. If we ran them all together, we would have a primordial sound. The primordial sound would also structure the mind. Not because the primordial sound is in some kind of inexplicable way structuring the mind, but because it presents in its briefness the entire structuring capacity of the alphabet. Now this is extremely important. It tells us a profound quality of the mind, which is not dependent upon any kind of religious or philosophic predisposition which we have. The fact that any structured order in language focuses the mind is the very, can I use a metaphor here? It's the very crux of the Hermetic tradition. The Hermetic tradition being that sealed wisdom tradition that has been around for as long as the hills have been around, at least 5,000 years in writing, and is even said to have originated writing. The backbone of civilization, all civilizations. If we wish to focus our minds, we use a structured language. And the structured language need not be philosophically informed. It's not dependent on the content. The structuring function orders the mind, so that just saying A, B, C, D, E, F, G will order the mind. Now, the discovery that this is so was made in Egypt. The discovery that this was so was made in Egypt, and as far as we know, the flourishing of the Old Kingdom in Egypt was a direct outcome of this discovery, of this primordial discovery. And like selecting out the essentials, selecting out the vowels in the alphabet, for instance, and then just using the essentials to order the mind, was understood also at that early time. But in a projected way, in using the mind to think about this, what does this mean then? What can we do with it? The perception was that there are basic forms, symbolic forms, which will order the mind, not just the mind of an individual or the mind of a group, a community, but if the projected symbol is graphic enough, it will order the mind of the civilization. So in the Old Kingdom in Egypt, the discovery that this was so not only came into a powerful new kind of language, a written language, but very quickly the genius of man amplified that instead of just taking the vowels now in sound, let's take the basic vocabulary of space, the basic planes, and let's come up with the basic geometric shapes. And the most powerful is the first geometric shape that has a sphericality to it, the pyramid. And so suddenly you see, within a generation of discovering the symbolic power of language, you see pyramids being built in ancient Egypt. Why? Because this would be a way of ordering the mind of a civilization. And what characterizes the Old Kingdom in ancient Egypt is that it's the first civilization that we know of that has a, I guess the term that we use now derisively, but originally it was not derisively used. It has a monolithic mind. Everyone had the same kind of structuring disposition, so that whatever was said, especially whatever was written, held with those people. It was like the minds of the people were the software and the hardware were the powerful symbols which worked in their magic way. But notice that the magic that is here is a symbolic magic. And when we critically go to try and understand what is that function that makes this symbolic activity so effective, that function turns out not to be imagination, but something which orders imagination. There is a power of the mind which is so strong that it orders imagination. And that power is memory. And when memory is trained, memory dominates imagination, like imagination, when it's trained, dominates all else. If you think that having creative visualization gives you power, you would be astounded at what a trained memory can do. Now, this powerful discovery in the Old Kingdom in Egypt was understandably kept to a very esoteric elite few. The Egyptian priesthoods never let it out. It was never public knowledge. The first time that it ever became public knowledge was in Greece, in Athens, and the figure who introduced it publicly was Themistocles. It's a famous figure in 5th century Athenian society. If you see the film Lawrence of Arabia that's replaying again, Lawrence says of himself that he's like Themistocles, who, while he cannot dabble, he can build an empire. Themistocles was famous for having the most Protean, colossal mind and intelligence at that time. He was able to think of everything. He is the one who introduced publicly the art of memory. He's not the originator of it, but he's the one that makes it go public. He's the one that tells the ancient secret. And you have a flash of brilliance in the Athens of that time because you have a population, not a large population, but you have a population of several dozens of individuals who understand very profoundly how using the new mnemonic consciousness to order imagery, which then orders everything else. And if you've ever wondered why all of a sudden, from one generation to another in one city, Athens in its heyday was never more than 200,000 people, smaller than Fresno. But it dominated the world. And out of that 200,000 people, there were about 400 or 500 people who really made that. You can see what a tremendous power of mind there is here. In our civilized educational tradition, we do not have anything from Themistocles. We have Plutarch's Life of Themistocles, which is our basic source. But the thinker, the man, the philosopher, the person who transmits to us that art of memory is Cicero. And one of the reasons why in the Renaissance Cicero was found to be a favorite author. And from the Renaissance through the Enlightenment, Cicero was given especially to promising young boys to read. Read your Cicero. Why? Well, they would say on the surface, well, it's because we want you to write good Latin, and he writes exquisite Latin. But the real reason is that the powerful ideas that are transmitted in Cicero make civilization, not only Greece, but the amplified Greece, the Greco-Roman world, the Roman Empire, Western civilization, is all founded on the same narrow core of principles, and the arcane one in that, the golden thread, is the training of memory. Because a person with a trained memory can dominate the imagination of the many very, very easily. It's not hard to do at all. In Cicero, the place that is usually given for the art of memory, and I'll come back to it, is in one of his books that has come down called Ad Herennium. Herennium was a man, and ad is the Latin for two, and it's a letter to Herennius. The Ad Herennium, and sometimes they add on there rhetorica, which means because this is an art of thinking and speaking in ordered arrangements. The Loeb Classical Library from Harvard University has published Rhetorica Ad Herennium. And you can find it around, usually UCLA will carry it, or USC. And on page 209 of the volume, starting at section 17, is the classic presentation of the art of memory. But it's not the only place in Cicero, and it's not the best place to start. For someone who has a classical background, as I do, or as the author whose book we're getting to now in the magic section, Frances Yates, The Art of Memory, she goes to another presentation of it in Cicero first. And the other presentation comes from one of Cicero's greatest volumes, probably if you read only one book of Cicero, De Oratore, De O-R-A-T-O-R-E, De Oratore, How to Speak, The Art of Speaking. But the art of speaking, not just in speaking, but the art of speaking from the organized mind. And one might say that the organized mind gives you a verbal written composition. That all the principles of composition now are brought back into speaking, so that where writing is much more powerful than speaking, if you take the essential symbolic structure of good writing and put it into speaking, a person speaking becomes charismatic. Now, some people find it by chance. And some people, most people, have to be taught. I suppose Shakespeare's a wonderful phrase on glory that he puts in the mouth of Malvolio in Twelfth Night, that some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them. I suppose you can have this kind of a categorization. Cicero tells us that the art of memory, now he's not going to go back to the ancient Egyptian because this is an esoteric understanding, even in Cicero's time. If you knew, you didn't talk about it. You certainly didn't talk about it in print. And believe me that Cicero was a very arcane human being. Cicero's great philosophic teacher, Posidonius, was the greatest mind of his time. And we don't have any of his writings at all. They were all destroyed because they were all a threat to the emerging state in the 4th century AD. The new Roman Empire, under the aegis of a Christianity, protected itself by getting rid of competition. But Cicero is extremely accurate in that he tells of a Greek poet the quality of discovery of the art of memory, which is most certainly true in the sense that this is probably how man actually discovered it, only it was an ancient Egyptian that originally discovered it. But he tells it of a Greek poet, Simonides of Ceos. Simonides is a lyric poet somewhere around the late 7th century AD, Simonides. Simonides was at a banquet. Many distinguished men around, and everybody was giving their panegyric, their kind of toast between the cups of wine. And when it came time for Simonides, in his panegyric he praised not only the host, but he praised Castor and Pollux, two of the early kind of celestial divinities. At any rate, the host, when it came his turn, said that Simonides would not receive any more from him, that he could petition Castor and Pollux for anything else that was to come. And then a messenger came, calling Simonides to the door. And he left the banquet and went out, but there was no one there. And while he was out, the roof of the house fell in and killed everyone at the banquet. And they were so mangled and so mashed, no one could identify the bodies, but they were mashed in their places. And so they called upon Simonides to remember who was in what place to identify the bodies for burial. The discovery of the art of memory was a gift from the gods, Castor and Pollux, to Simonides. Because he realized that by focusing on the place, the places, the arrangement, that the content of the places was in the places. That just remembering the places, if you remembered the places with a little bit of an oomph, the content of the places would disclose itself to you automatically, as it were. And that it would be even more powerful, even more indelible, even more extensive if you trained yourself to put content into place orders, and then you would just arrange the places. And not only that, but you could take those places and arrange them in a new order and put those into places, and you could build up an incredibly refined grid so that eventually all you had to do to key in this entire mass of structure was just to remember one place. And usually, because in the esoteric tradition, because this was religious knowledge, you would be taught that the one place was your soul. You begin with your own self-presence, your own deep presence. So that the ultimate symbol for storing all knowledge was the self. First know yourself, and then it will follow as the day follows the night. You shall know all things. It's not just a classic homily, as you can see, but it is a specific structure of truthful functioning. Now, this discovery, the Latin term for place was loci, L-O-C-I. And in De Oratoria, generally what you have in here is that you put the image in the place. Later on, because of the need for a certain amount of cuteness and liveliness with students, the Latin tradition came to be loci et foci. That was the mnemonic cue, loci et foci. Places and focuses. But the actual operative way was to put the images in those places. So when you focused on the place, the imagery would come out. Now notice what this does. It takes an image base and makes it subservient to a structuring process. So that the meaning is in the structure and not in the images. The meaning is in the structure and not in the images. What do the images have? The images have feeling tone. But the feeling tone is not in the imagination, it's in the body. When you imagine an image, imagine an orange. Really imagine a nice, big, juicy orange with its sweet acidity and its kind of crunchy pulp. You see how the imagination now cues the body. The feeling is in the body. The image controls the body. So that the feeling-toned image is the essence of the body. But the essence of the feeling-toned image base is the structure of its arrangement. And it's just in this way that imagery is interiorized. I don't mean that the images that you have aren't already interior. It isn't just that the image that you have is a representation interiorly of something outside. I see this figure, and I have an image of this figure. It isn't that. As soon as I do not look at this, do not perceive this, then the image is not there. The only way that image can be there again is through memory. So that the image occurring in me interiorly, corresponding to this physical statue here, that it does not interiorize the image. What interiorizes it is a structure. Now, if I put these two images together, and I note that one is a farmer, and one is a scholar, and I say to myself that this is the real Tai Chi, work and study. Now I have a structure which I can interiorize in terms of its meaning. The structure now becomes powerful symbolically in that I can take these two figures away. And I can take the meaning that work and study are the real Tai Chi. And I can cue in these statuettes as images to illustrate that. But what has happened is that the images have come together in a structure and have become an idea. Can you see that even in such an instant, small example, the mind has increased its power incredibly? One now, if one trains oneself on this kind of basis, there's an unlimited field of capacity which you can engender in yourself. It is simply unlimited. There's no limitation whatsoever. It's like a Promethean gift of God to man to know that he has this. Not just to have it, but to know that he has this. In Frances Yates' book, The Art of Memory, after her first chapter, Three Latin Sources for the Classical Art of Memory, also in Quintilian, the Institutes, there is a presentation of it. She has a chapter here, chapter 2, and if you can get a chance, I would like you to read chapter 2. If you don't have the book, we can make copies for you on the copy machine here. Chapter 2 is The Art of Memory in Greece, Memory and the Soul. Memory and the Soul. For you must understand from my preliminary comments here to you that the whole quality of self-presence is correlated to the ability for your memory to function accurately. This is why the Delphic maxim, that is the saying that the Delphic oracle gave to Socrates, has been used ever since as the quintessence of the Western way. The Delphic maxim is, know thyself. How do you know yourself? You remember who you are, where you are. You see. Now, remembering yourself, bringing your consciousness into a stillness within, that's the most arcane place that there is in the universe. Because that place has enfolded in it every other key to every other place that there is. There is no place that there is that is not there. Why is this so? That it is so gives us a kind of an insight into the nature of reality. There is no way that we put all of that information there. We didn't put all those images there. We certainly didn't do it in this lifetime. And we certainly would not have had enough reincarnations to do this. It means that in an a priori way, in a primordial, before the events occurred in our limited perspective, that the entire structure of whatever is within us, but is only able to be cued if we can have that single-pointedness of self. The Sanskrit word for this, and you must understand that India is a part of Western civilization, is the same psyche that we do. Ekagrata, the single-pointedness. All yoga is possible because of this function. And it's just like the ordering of the image base by the memory, and the ordering of the memory by the self. This is the whole purpose of a yoga. But in a yoga, one translates it to a physical body. You can translate it to a physical body. You can translate it to a person. You can translate it to a group. You can translate it. There is such a thing as a yoga of civilization. There is such a thing. It actually occurs. Very rare. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I'm reminded of a little story in Chuangzi where there's this little bird that hops from bush to bush. And it hears that there's this bird that is so large that when it flaps its wings once, it goes from north to south. And the little birds that flit from bush to bush say, well, that's impossible. That can't be. We have trouble getting from bush to bush. There can't be any such bird. But there is. There are. So coming back to Yeats now, Francis Yeates, who's a trustworthy person, very trustworthy, a mentor, trusting teacher, teacher of the soul. Chapter 2, The Art of Memory in Greece, Memory and the Soul. And she writes here, the Simonides story, with its gruesome evocation of the faces of the people sitting in their places at the banquet just before their awful end, may suggest that the human images were an integral part of the art of memory, which Greece transmitted to Rome. According to Quintilian, there were several versions of the story extant in Greek sources, and one may perhaps conjecture that it formed the normal introduction to the section on artificial memory in a textbook on rhetoric. There were certainly many such in Greek, but they have not come down to us. Hence our dependence on the three Latin sources for any conjecture we may make concerning Greek artificial memory. And skip over here to Aristotle was certainly familiar with the artificial memory, which he refers to four times, not as an expositor of it, though according to Diogenes Laertius, who was a Roman collector of lives of philosophers, Aristotle wrote a book on mnemonics which is not extant, which tells you something. When you realize what a large body of works of Aristotle have survived, why is the art of memory by Aristotle not surviving? Because it was esoteric. But the art of memory of Aristotle does survive. It survives in a very esoteric manuscript known as the Secret of Secrets. And it proverbially was the instruction that Aristotle gave to Alexander the Great, and that the instruction was all written down. And that instruction survived in Arab civilization. The Secretorium Secretum. I have a copy of it, translated into English, done in Oxford in 1920. The person who revived it, that is, who brought the manuscript back, was Roger Bacon, the great thinker of the 13th century. But one of the incidents to illustrate the points under discussion occurs in Aristotle's book, The Topics, when he is advising that one should commit to memory arguments upon questions which are of the most frequent occurrence. Commit to memory arguments. This is not practiced in our age very much. I was trained in this by Julius Weinberg at the University of Wisconsin, because he was, at the time that I was studying under him, writing a book on medieval philosophy, which was subsequently published by Princeton University Press. We have a copy of it here. He was working on that book at the time, so the few students that were with him, we got a classic high medieval education under him, and remembering arguments was part of it. It's not as simple as you might think. You have to be able to deliver the pro and the con of the arguments impeccably, which means that in order to do this accurately, you have to suspend your own personal belief, your own personal compulsion for bias. As soon as you have any kind of a compulsion for bias, you skew what you remember. It's like you let the images influence you. And your sense of structural precision is deformed by just the extent that you are tainted by the images controlling your feeling. So that in order to do this, one has to be almost yoga-like dispassionate, the yoga of the Christian Middle Ages, the yoga of the Jewish Middle Ages, the yoga of the Islamic Middle Ages was to remember arguments. And Aristotle and his Topics was the basis of that. So that the prize would be if you could deliver the pro and the con of a situation, both arguments, or sometimes there would be multiple pros and multiple cons. There would be little, like what we have today are like truth trees in logic. Well, in the medieval version, you would be able to deliver every viewpoint accurately. So that someone else, if you were a student, it would be the teacher. But if it were among educated people, it would be your peers. How wonderful it is that so-and-so could present the whole range of arguments on this issue. What a wonderful quality of self-presence so-and-so has. What a wonderful soul so-and-so has, to be so clear and so pure in himself as to be able to give the complete rendition of all sides of this question. Such a soul is seated in the seat of justice, is seated on the interior throne, is in possession of the chariot of the senses. Notice how all these primordial images now still occur, like, for instance, in tarot cards. Justice, the chariot, so forth. The emperor, the empress. Women could do this too. It is a tribute to our abilities here, not to my abilities, but to your abilities, to continue to come and be here and make this happening, form it, that material like this is able to be understood in its exactness and excellence. I taught in universities for 10 years as a professor, and there's no way that you can say something like this to a university class. They don't have the preparation. They don't have the functioning integral patterning, which you have, to be able to hear quite exactly the significance of this. The most you can do in a university is simply to hope that you can teach them to teach the students to remember one argument as best as they can, the pros and cons of one argument. Here is a quotation from Aristotle's Topics. This is Topics 163b. We have the works of Aristotle here in many translations, and Ross's edition of the Topics is the one that we have. It's the best there is. This is Aristotle. For just as a person with a trained memory, for just as in a person with a trained memory, a memory of things themselves is immediately caused by the mere mention of their places. Now, places in Latin is loci, but places in Greek is topoi, like in mathematics. You still have that. So that the Aristotle's Topics, the whole book, the whole book is an exercise in a facet of the art of memory. It isn't topics like in subjects. But notice the esoteric connotation, even in the English language. Topics as subjects. The topoi as subjects. The topoi are the keys to the places in the memory. And the subjects are all unified by a subject, the subjective, the inner self. Notice how the language still has its correlating cognates. That's because the English language is founded very accurately on the Greek. Not just the Latin, but the Greek. The profound esoteric Greek soul structure is in the English language. How did it get there? It got there because when English was being made as a language in the 7th century AD, it was put in there. The first great use of the English language is done by the Venerable Bede, which is an esoteric history of the Christian Church. And at the end of Bede's life, he wrote the great national epic of England, Beowulf. And you can see in Beowulf around 720 AD, just a monumental use, even in Old English you can see it, a monumental use of esoteric Greek mental training. And in committing Beowulf to memory, one trains the mind in just doing that, because the whole composition of it is done in the classic art of memory. So that already in the early 700s AD, English as a language was literally engineered into a position to be able to be effective. And that quality languished somewhat because there were many recessions in civilization. But the person who brought it back out again and made it shine was Chaucer. And in Chaucer, you have, for instance, like in the Canterbury Tales, is the author presenting the 28 different styles of human beings. Now, in order to present accurately the 28 different styles of human beings, the author has to be able to understand all of them from a point that is not co-opted by any of them. It's like in a very simple way, Chaucer, in doing the Canterbury Tales, is saying, there's someone here who understands man. Well, that's a very great thing. You have to have a real high self-presence, real high yoga of civilization to be able to understand all the variations of man and to be able to accurately present it. And then, of course, Chaucer's golden sun of humanity in the Canterbury Tales is given almost like a supernova brilliance in Shakespeare, who writes of characters and qualities of characters that just are all of humanity, not just 28 different, but hundreds of characters. And so the English language has a tremendous capacity in the structure of its language. It's one of the most difficult languages to use, because to make it work properly, one has to have a very high quality of interior soul. And if you do, the English language can sing. It's like ancient Greek or like ancient Sanskrit. When you have a very high quality of soul, the language becomes elegantly facile, able to move sinuously with great continuity over the whole spread of whatever one wishes to say, to express. The entire sphere of expression becomes available to one. In just the same way, higher mathematics, calculus and so forth, are universal languages, because in their capacity, they're able to express whatever you wish to express. There's no limit. Whatever you wish to express can be expressed. And there are these functions of language. So here in Aristotle's quotation in Francis Yates' second chapter in The Art of Memory, from the Topics, the Topoi, Aristotle, "For just as in a person with a trained memory, a memory of things themselves is immediately caused by the mere mention of their topoi, places, so these habits, too, will make a man readier in reasoning because he has his premises classified before his mind's eye, each under its number. And then she writes, Francis Yates writes, there can be no doubt that these topoi, used by persons with a trained memory, must be mnemonic loci. And it is indeed probable that the very word topics, as used in dialectics, arose through the places of mnemonics. Topics are the things, or subject matter, of dialectic, which came to be known as topoi, through the places in which they were stored. And in the day insomnes, that is on dreams, day insomnes, Aristotle says that some people have dreams in which they seem to be arranging the objects before them in accordance with their mnemonic system. Rather a warning, one would think, against doing too much artificial memory, though this is not how he is using the illusion. And in the De Anima, that's on the soul, there is a similar phrase. It is possible to put things before our eyes, just as those do who in